leave.
Very well.
She fell back from him, panting, transfigured by her passion.
I will give you a price,
she raved, tearing away her tunic from her ivory breasts.
Am I not fair? Am I not more desirable than these soot-colored wenches? Am I not a worthy reward for bloodletting? Is not a fair-skinned virgin a price worth slaying for? Kill that black dog, Bajuj. Let me see his cursed head roll in the bloody dust. Kill him! Kill him!
She beat her clenched fists together in the agony of her intensity.
Then take me and do as you wish with me. I will be your slave.
He did not speak for an instant, but stood like a giant brooding figure of slaughter and destruction, fingering his hilt.
You speak as if you were free to give yourself at your pleasure, he said, as if the gift of your body had power to swing kingdoms. Why should I kill Bajuj to obtain you? Women are cheap as plantains in this land, and their willingness or unwillingness matters as little. You value yourself too highly. If I wanted you, I wouldn't have to fight Bajuj to take you. He would rather give you to me than to fight me.
Livia gasped. All the fire went out of her. The hut reeled dizzily before her eyes. She staggered and sank in a crumpled heap on an angareb. Dazed bitterness crushed her soul as the realization of her utter helplessness was thrust brutally upon her. The human mind clings unconsciously to familiar values and ideas, even among surroundings and conditions alien and unrelated to those environs to which such values and ideas are adapted. In spite of all Livia had experienced, she had still instinctively supposed a woman's consent the pivotal point of such a game as she proposed to play. She was stunned by the realization that nothing hinged upon her at all. She could not move men as pawns in a game. She herself was the helpless pawn.
I see the absurdity of supposing that any man in this corner of the world would act according to rules and customs existent in another corner of the planet,
she murmured weakly, scarcely conscious of what she was saying, which was indeed only the vocal framing of the thought which overcame her. Stunned by that newest twist of fate, she lay motionless, until the white barbarian's iron fingers closed on her shoulders and lifted her again to her feet.
You said I was a barbarian, he said harshly, and that is true. Crom be thanked. If you had had men of the outlands guarding you instead of soft-gutted civilized weaklings, you would not be the slave of a black pig this night. I am Conan, a Cimmerian, and I live by the sword's edge. But I am not such a dog as to leave a white woman in the clutches of a black man. And though your kind call me a robber, I never forced a woman against her consent. Customs differ in various countries, but if a man is strong enough, he can enforce a few of his native customs anywhere. And no man ever called me a weakling. If you are old and ugly as the devil's pet vulture, I'd take you away from Bajuj, simply because of the color of your hide. But you are young and beautiful, and I have looked at black sluts until I am sick at the guts. I'll play this game your way, simply because some of your instincts correspond with some of mine. Get back to your hut. Bajuj is too drunk to come to you tonight, and I'll see that he's occupied tomorrow. And tomorrow night it will be Conan's bed you'll warm, not Bajuj's.
How will it be accomplished?
She was trembling with mingled emotions.
Are these all your warriors?
They're enough, he grunted. Bamulas, every one of them, and suckled at the teats of war. I came here at Bajuj's request. He wants me to join him in an attack on Jihiji. Tonight we feasted. Tomorrow we hold council. When I get through with him, he'll be holding council in hell.
You will break the truce?
Truces in this land are made to be broken, he answered grimly. He would break his truce with Jihiji. And after we'd looted the town together, he'd wipe me out the first time he caught me off guard. What would be blackest treachery in another land is wisdom here. I have not fought my way alone to the position of war chief of the Bamulas without learning all the lessons the black country teaches. Now, go back to your hut and sleep, knowing that it is not for Bajuja, but for Conan that you preserve your beauty. 2. Through the crack in the bamboo wall, Livia watched, her nerves taut and trembling. All day, since their late waking, bleary and sodden from their debauch of the night before, the black people had prepared the feast for the coming night. All day, Conan the Cimmerian had sat in the hut of Bajuj, and what had passed between them Livia could not know. She had fought to hide her excitement from the only person who entered her hut, the vindictive black girl who brought her food and drink. But that ribald wench had been too groggy from her libations of the previous night to notice the change in her captive's demeanor. Now, night had fallen again. Fires lighted the village, and once more the chiefs left the king's hut and squatted down in the open space between the huts to feast and hold a final, ceremonious council. This time there was not so much beer guzzling. Livia noticed the Bamulas casually converging toward the circle where sat the chief men. She saw Bajuj, and sitting opposite him across the eating pots, Conan, laughing and conversing with the giant Aja, Bajuj's war chief. The Cimmerian was gnawing a great beef bone, and as she watched, she saw him cast a glance across his shoulder. As if it were a signal for which they had been waiting, the Bamulas all turned their gaze toward their chief. Conan rose, still smiling, as if to reach into a nearby cooking pot. Then, quick as a cat, he struck Aja a terrible blow with a heavy bone. The Bakala war chief slumped over, his skull crushed in, and instantly a frightful yell rent the skies as the Bamulas went into action like blood-mad panthers. Cooking pots overturned, scalding the squatting women, bamboo walls buckled to the impact of plunging bodies, screams of agony ripped the night, and over all rose the exultant "Tee-yee-yee!" of the maddened Bamulas, the flame of spears that crimsoned in the lurid glow. Bakala was a madhouse that reddened into a shambles. The action of the invaders paralyzed the luckless villagers by its unexpected suddenness. No thought of attack by their guests had ever entered their woolly pates. Most of the spears were stacked in the huts, many of the warriors already half-drunk. The fall of Aja was a signal that plunged the gleaming blades of the Bamulas into 100 unsuspecting bodies. After that, it was a massacre. At her peephole, Livia stood frozen, white as a statue, her golden locks drawn back and grasped in a knotted cluster with both hands at her temples. Her eyes were dilated, her whole body rigid. The yells of pain and fury smote her tortured nerves like a physical impact. The writhing, slashing forms blurred before her, then sprang out again with horrifying distinctness. She saw spears sink into writhing black bodies, spilling red. She saw clubs swing and descend with brutal force on kinky heads. Brands were kicked out of the fires, scattering sparks. Hot thatches smoldered and blazed up. A fresh stridency of anguish cut through the cries as living victims were hurled headfirst into the blazing structures. The scent of scorched flesh began to sicken the air, already rank with reeking sweat and fresh blood. Livia's overwrought nerves gave way. She cried out again and again, shrill screams of torrent lost in the roar of flames and slaughter. She beat her temples with her clenched fists. Her reason tottered, changing her cries to more awful peals of hysterical laughter. In vain, she sought to keep before her the fact that it was her enemies who were dying thus horribly, that this was as she had madly hoped and plotted,
that this ghastly sacrifice was but a just repayment for the wrongs done her and hers. Frantic terror held her in its unreasoning grasp. She was aware of no pity for the victims who were dying wholesale under the dripping spears. Her only emotion was blind, stark, mad, unreasoning fear. She saw Conan, his white form contrasting with the black's. She saw his sword flash, and men went down around him. Now a struggling knot swept around a fire, and she glimpsed a fat, squat shape writhing in its midst. Conan plowed through and was hidden from view by the twisting black figures. From the midst, a thin squealing rose unbearably. The press split for an instant, and she had one awful glimpse of a reeling, desperate, squat figure, streaming blood. Then the throng crowded in again, and steel flashed in the mob like a beam of lightning through the dusk. A beast-like baying rose, terrifying in its primitive exultation. Through the mob, Conan's tall form pushed its way. He was striding toward the hut where the girl cowered, and in his hand he bore a ghastly relic. The firelight gleamed redly on King Bajuja's severed head. The black eyes, glassy now instead of vital, rolled up, revealing only the whites. The jaw hung slack as if in a grin of idiocy. Red drops showered thickly along the ground. Livia gave back with a moaning cry. Conan had paid the price and was coming to claim her, bearing the awful token of his payment. He would grasp her with his hot, bloody fingers, crush her lips with mouth still panting from the slaughter. With the thought came delirium. With a scream, Livia ran across the hut, threw herself against the door in the back wall. It fell open and she darted across the open space, a flitting white ghost in a realm of black shadows and red flame. Some obscure instinct led her to the pen where the horses were kept. A warrior was just taking down the bars that separated the horse pen from the main boma, and he yelled in amazement as she darted past him. His dusky hand clutched at her, closed on the neck of her tunic. With a frantic jerk, she tore away, leaving the garment in his hand. The horses snorted and stampeded past her, rolling the black man in the dust. Lean, wiry steeds of the Kushite breed, already frantic with the fire and the scent of blood. Blindly, she caught at a flying mane, was jerked off her feet, struck the ground again on her toes, sprang high, pulled, and scrambled herself upon the horse's straining back. Mad with fear, the herd plunged through the fires, their small hoofs knocking sparks in a blinding shower. The startled black people had a wild glimpse of the girl clinging naked to the mane of a beast that raced like the wind that streamed out of his rider's loose yellow hair. Then, straight for the boma, the steed bolted, soared breathtakingly into the air, and was gone into the night. 3. Livia could make no attempt to guide her steed, nor did she feel any need of so doing. The yells and the glow of the fires were fading out behind her. The wind tossed her hair and caressed her naked limbs. She was aware only of a dazed need to hold to the flowing mane and ride, ride, ride over the rim of the world and away from all agony and grief and horror. And for hours the wiry steed raced until, topping a starlit crest, he stumbled and hurled his rider headlong. She struck on soft cushioning sward and lay for an instant half stunned, dimly hearing her mount trot away. When she staggered up, the first thing that impressed her was the silence. It was an almost tangible thing, soft, darkly velvet, after the incessant blare of barbaric horns and drums which had maddened her for days. She stared up at the great white stars clustered thickly in the dark blue sky. There was no moon, yet the starlight illuminated the land, though invisibly, with unexpected clusterings of shadow. She stood on a swarded eminence from which the gently molded slopes ran away, soft as velvet under the starlight, Far away in one direction, she discerned a dense, dark line of trees which marked the distant forest. Here there was only night and trance-like stillness, and a faint breeze blowing through the stars. The land seemed vast and slumbering. The warm caress of the breeze made her aware of her nakedness, and she wriggled uneasily, spreading her hands over her body. Then she felt the loneliness of the night and the unbrokenness of the solitude. She was alone. She stood naked on the summit of the land, and there was none to see. Nothing but night and the whispering wind. She was suddenly glad of the night and the loneliness. There was none to threaten her, or to seize her with rude, violent hands. She looked before her and saw the slope falling away into a broad valley. There, fronds waved thickly, and the starlight reflected whitely on many small objects scattered throughout the vale. She thought they were great white blossoms, and the thought gave rise to vague memory. She thought of a valley of which the blacks had spoken with fear, a valley to which had fled the young women of a strange brown-skinned race which had inhabited the land before the coming of the ancestors of the Bacchalas. There, men said, they had turned into white flowers, had been transformed by the old gods to escape their ravishers, where no black man dared go. But into that valley Livia dared go. She would go down those grassy slopes, which were like velvet under her tender feet. She would dwell there among the nodding white blossoms, and no man would ever come to lay hot, rude hands on her. Conan had said that pacts were made to be broken. She would break her pact with him. She would go into the Vale of the Lost Women. She would lose herself in solitude and stillness. Even as these dreamy and disjointed thoughts floated through her consciousness, she was descending the gentle slopes, and the tiers of the valley walls were rising higher on each hand. But so gentle were their slopes that when she stood on the valley floor, she did not have the feeling of being imprisoned by rugged walls. All about her floated seas of shadow, and great white blossoms nodded and whispered to her. She wandered at random, parting the fronds before her with her small hands, listening to the whisper of the wind through the leaves, finding a childish pleasure in the gurgling of an unseen stream. She moved as in a dream, in the grasp of a strange unreality. One thought reiterated itself continually. There she was safe from the brutality of men. She wept, but the tears were of joy. She lay full length upon the sward and clutched the soft grass as if she would crush her newfound refuge to her breast and hold it there forever. She plucked the petals of the great white blossoms and fashioned them into a chaplet for her golden hair. Their perfume was in keeping with all other things in the valley, dreamy, subtle, enchanting. So she came at last to a glade in the midst of the valley, and saw there a great stone, hewn as if by human hands, and adorned with ferns and blossoms and chains of flowers. She stood staring at it, and then there was movement and life about her. Turning, she saw figures stealing from the denser shadows. Slender brown women, lithe, naked, with blossoms in their night-black hair. Like creatures of a dream they came about her, and they did not speak. But suddenly, terror seized her as she looked into their eyes. Those eyes were luminous, radiant in the starshine, but they were not human eyes. The forms were human, but in the souls a strange change had been wrought, a change reflected in their glowing eyes. Fear descended on Livia in a wave. The serpent reared its grisly head in her new-found paradise. But she could not flee. The lithe brown women were all about her. One, lovelier than the rest, came silently up to the trembling girl and enfolded her with supple brown arms. Her breath was scented with the same perfume that stole from the great white blossoms that waved in the starshine. Her lips pressed Livia's in a long, terrible kiss. The Ophirian felt coldness running through her veins. Her limbs turned brittle. Like a white statue of marble, she lay in the arms of her captress, incapable of speech or movement. Quick, soft hands lifted her and laid her on the altar stone amidst a bed of flowers. The brown women joined hands in a ring and moved supplely about the altar, dancing a strange, dark measure. Never the sun or the moon looked on such a dance, and the great white stars grew whiter and glowed with a more luminous light, as if its dark witchery struck response in things cosmic and elemental. And a low chant arose that was less human than the gurgling of the distant stream. A rustle of voices like the whispering of the great white blossoms that waved beneath the stars. Livia lay, conscious, but without power of movement. It did not occur to her to doubt her sanity. She sought not to reason or analyze. She was, and these strange beings dancing around her were. A dumb realization of existence and recognition of the actuality of nightmare possessed her, as she lay helplessly gazing up at the star-clustered sky, whence she somehow knew with more than mortal knowledge some thing would come to her, as it had come long ago to make these naked brown women the soulless beings they now were. First, high above her, she saw a black dot among the stars, which grew and expanded. It neared her. It swelled to a bat, and still it grew, though its shape did not alter further to any great extent. It hovered over her in the stars, dropping plummet-like earthward, its great wings spread over her. She lay in its tenebrous shadow, and all about her the chant rose higher, to a soft paean of soulless joy, a welcome to the god which came to claim a fresh sacrifice, fresh and rose-pink as a flower in the dew of dawn. Now it hung directly over her, and her soul shriveled and grew chill and small at the sight. Its wings were bat-like, but its body and the dim face that gazed down upon her were like nothing of sea or earth or air. She knew she looked upon ultimate horror, upon black cosmic foulness born in night-black gulfs beyond the reach of a madman's wildest dreams. Breaking the unseen bonds that held her dumb, she screamed awfully. Her cry was answered by a deep, menacing shout. She heard the pounding of rushing feet. All about her there was a swirl as of swift waters. The white blossoms tossed wildly, and the brown women were gone. Over her hovered the great black shadow, and she saw a tall white figure with plumes nodding in the stars rushing toward her.
"Conan!"
The cry broke involuntarily from her lips. With a fierce, inarticulate yell, the barbarian sprang into the air, lashing upward with his sword that flamed in the starlight. The great black wings rose and fell. Livia, dumb with horror, saw the Cimmerian enveloped in the black shadow that hung over him. The man's breath came pantingly. His feet stamped the beaten earth, crushing the white blossoms into the dirt. The rending impact of his blows echoed through the night. He was hurled back and forth like a rat in the grip of a hound. Blood splashed thickly on the sward, mingling with the white petals that lay strewn like a carpet. And then the girl, watching that devilish battle as in a nightmare, saw the black-winged thing waver and stagger in midair. There was a threshing beat of crippled wings, and the monster had torn clear and was soaring upward to mingle and vanish among the stars. Its conqueror staggered dizzily, sword poised, legs wide braced, staring upward stupidly, amazed at victory, but ready to take up again the ghastly battle. An instant later, Conan approached the altar, panting, dripping blood at every step. His massive chest heaved, glistening with perspiration. Blood ran down his arms in streams from his neck and shoulders. As he touched her, the spell on the girl was broken, and she scrambled up and slid from the altar, recoiling from his hand. He leaned against the stone, looking down at her, where she cowered at his feet.
"Men saw you ride out of the village," he said. "I followed as soon as I could, and picked up your track, though it was no easy task following it by torchlight. I tracked you to the place where your horse threw you, and though the torches were exhausted by then, and I could not find the prints of your bare feet on the sward, I felt sure you had descended into the valley. My men would not follow me, so I came alone on foot." "What veil of devils is this? What was that thing?"
"A god," she whispered. "The black people spoke of it. A god from far away and long ago."
"A devil from the outer dark," he grunted. "Oh, they're nothing uncommon. They lurk as thick as fleas outside the belt of light which surrounds this world. I have heard the wise men of Zamora talk of them. Some find their way to Earth. But when they do, they have to take on earthly form and flesh of some sort. A man like myself with a sword is a match for any amount of fangs and talons, infernal or terrestrial. Come. My men await me beyond the ridge of the valley."
She crouched motionless, unable to find words, while he frowned down at her. Then she spoke.
"I ran away from you. I planned to dupe you. I was not going to keep my promise to you. I was yours by the bargain we made, but I would have escaped from you if I could. Punish me as you will."
He shook the sweat and blood from his locks and sheathed his sword.
"Get up," he grunted. "It was a foul bargain I made. I do not regret that black dog Bajuj, but you are no wench to be bought and sold. The ways of men vary in different lands, but a man need not be a swine wherever he is. After I thought a while, I saw that to hold you to your bargain would be the same as if I had forced you. Besides, you are not tough enough for this land. You are a child of cities and books and civilized ways, which isn't your fault, but you die quickly following the life I thrive on. A dead woman would be no good to me. I will take you to the Stygian borders. The Stygians will send you home to Ophir."
She stared up at him as if she had not heard aright.
"Home?" she repeated mechanically. "Home? Ophir? My people? Cities, towers, peace, my home?"
Suddenly, tears welled into her eyes, and sinking to her knees, she embraced his knees in her arms.
"Crom, girl," grunted Conan, embarrassed. "Don't do that. You'd think I was doing you a favor by kicking you out of this country. Haven't I explained that you're not the proper woman for the war chief of the Bamulas?"
The Devil in Iron. The fisherman loosened his knife in its scabbard. The gesture was instinctive, for what he feared was nothing a knife could slay, not even the saw-edged crescent blade of the Yuetshi that could disembowel a man with an upward stroke. Neither man nor beast threatened him in the solitude which brooded over the castellated isle of Shapur. He had climbed the cliffs, passed through the jungle that bordered them, and now stood surrounded by evidences of a vanished state. Broken columns glimmered among the trees. The straggling lines of crumbling walls meandered off into the shadows, and under his feet were broad paves, cracked and bowed by roots growing beneath. The fisherman was typical of his race, that strange people whose origin is lost in the gray dawn of the past, and who have dwelt in their rude fishing huts along the southern shore of the Sea of Vilayet since time immemorial. He was broadly built, with long apish arms and a mighty chest, but with lean loins and thin bandy legs. His face was broad, his forehead low and retreating, his hair thick and tangled. A belt for a knife and a rag for a loincloth were all he wore in the way of clothing. That he was where he was proved that he was less dully incurious than most of his people. Men seldom visited Shapur. It was uninhabited, all but forgotten, merely one among the myriad isles which dotted the great inland sea. Men called it Shapur the Fortified because of its ruins, remnants of some prehistoric kingdom lost and forgotten before the conquering Hyborians had ridden southward. None knew who reared those stones, though dim legends lingered among the Yuetshi, which half intelligibly suggested a connection of immeasurable antiquity between the fishers and the unknown island kingdom. But it had been 1,000 years since any Yuetshi had understood the import of these tales. They repeated them now as a meaningless formula, a gibberish framed to their lips by custom. No Yuetshi had come to Shapur for a century. The adjacent coast of the mainland was uninhabited, a reedy marsh given over to the grim beasts that haunted it. The fisher's village lay some distance to the south on the mainland. A storm had blown his frail fishing craft far from its accustomed haunts and wrecked it in a night of flaring lightning and roaring waters on the towering cliffs of the isle. Now in the dawn the sky shone blue and clear. The rising sun made jewels of the dripping leaves. He had climbed the cliffs to which he had clung through the night because, in the midst of the storm, he had seen an appalling lance of lightning fork out of the black heavens, and the concussion of its stroke, which had shaken the whole island, had been accompanied by a cataclysmic crash that he doubted could have resulted from a riven tree. A dull curiosity had caused him to investigate, and now he had found what he sought, and an animal-like uneasiness possessed him. A sense of lurking peril. Among the trees reared a broken dome-like structure, built of gigantic blocks of the peculiar iron-like green stone found only on the islands of Vilayet. It seemed incredible that human hands could have shaped and placed them, and certainly it was beyond human power to have overthrown the structure they formed. But the thunderbolt had splintered the ton-heavy blocks like so much glass, reduced others to green dust, and ripped away the whole arch of the dome. The fisherman climbed over the debris and peered in, and what he saw brought a grunt from him. Within the ruined dome, surrounded by stone dust and bits of broken masonry, lay a man on a golden block. He was clad in a sort of skirt and a shagreen girdle. His black hair, which fell in a square mane to his massive shoulders, was confined about his temples by a narrow gold band. On his bare muscular breast lay a curious dagger with a jeweled pommel, shagreen-bound hilt, and a broad crescent blade. It was much like the knife the fisherman wore at his hip, but it lacked the serrated edge, and was made with infinitely greater skill. The fisherman lusted for the weapon. The man, of course, was dead, had been dead for many centuries. This dome was his tomb. The fisherman did not wonder by what art the ancients had preserved the body in such a vivid likeness of life, which kept the muscular limbs full and unshrunken, the dark flesh vital. The dull brain of the Yuetshi had room only for his desire for the knife with its delicate waving lines along the dully gleaming blade. Scrambling down into the dome, he lifted the weapon from the man's breast. And as he did so, a strange and terrible thing came to pass. The muscular dark hands knotted convulsively. The lids flared open, revealing great, dark, magnetic eyes, whose stare struck the startled fisherman like a physical blow. He recoiled, dropping the jeweled dagger in his perturbation. The man on the dais heaved up to a sitting position, and the fisherman gaped at the full extent of his size, thus revealed. His narrowed eyes held the Yuetshi, and in those slitted orbs he read neither friendliness nor gratitude. He saw only a fire as alien and hostile as that which burns in the eyes of a tiger. Suddenly, the man rose and towered above him, menace in his every aspect. There was no room in the fisherman's dull brain for fear. At least for such fear as might grip a man who has just seen the fundamental laws of nature defied.
As the great hands fell to his shoulders, he drew his saw-edged knife and struck upward with the same motion. The blade splintered against the stranger's corded belly, as against a steel column. And then the fisherman's thick neck broke like a rotten twig in the giant hands.
2. Jehungir Agha, lord of Khawarazm and keeper of the coastal border, scanned once more the ornate parchment scroll with its peacock seal, and laughed shortly and sardonically.
"Well?"
bluntly demanded his counselor, Ghaznavi. Jehungir shrugged his shoulders. He was a handsome man, with the merciless pride of birth and accomplishment. "The king grows short of patience," said he. "In his own hand he complains bitterly of what he calls my failure to guard the frontier. By Tarim, if I cannot deal a blow to these robbers of the steppes, Khawarazm may own a new lord." Ghaznavi tugged his gray-shot beard in meditation. Yezdegerd, king of Turan, was the mightiest monarch in the world. In his palace in the great port city of Agrapur was heaped the plunder of empires. His fleets of purple-sailed war galleys had made Vilayet an Hyrcanian lake. The dark-skinned people of Zamora paid him tribute, as did the eastern provinces of Koth. The Shemites bowed to his rule as far west as Shushan. His armies ravaged the borders of Stygia in the south and the snowy lands of the Hyperboreans in the north. His riders bore torch and sword westward into Brithunia and Ophir and Corinthia, even to the borders of Numidia. His gilt-helmeted swordsmen had trampled hosts under their horses' hooves, and walled cities went up in flames at his command. In the glutted slave markets of Agrapur, Sultanapur, Khawarazm, Shapur, and Khorasan, women were sold for 3 small silver coins. Blonde Brithunians, tawny Stygians, dark-haired Zamorians, ebon Cushites, olive-skinned Shemites. Yet, while his swift horsemen overthrew armies far from his frontiers, at his very borders an audacious foe plucked his beard with a red, dripping, and smoke-stained hand.
On the broad steppes between the Sea of Vilayet and the borders of the easternmost Hyborian kingdoms, a new race had sprung up in the past half-century, formed originally of fleeing criminals, broken men, escaped slaves, and deserting soldiers. They were men of many crimes and countries, some born on the steppes, some fleeing from the kingdoms in the west. They were called Kozak, which means wastrel.
Dwelling on the wild open steppes, owning no law but their own peculiar code, they had become a people capable even of defying the Grand Monarch. Ceaselessly they raided the Turanian frontier, retiring in the steppes when defeated. With the pirates of Vilayet, men of much the same breed, they harried the coast, preying off the merchant ships which plied between the Hyrcanian ports.
"How am I to crush these wolves?" demanded Jehungir. "If I follow them into the steppes, I run the risk either of being cut off and destroyed, or having them elude me entirely and burn the city in my absence. Of late they have been more daring than ever."
"That is because of the new chief who has risen among them," answered Ghaznavi. "You know whom I mean."
"Aye," replied Jehungir feelingly. "It is that devil Conan. He is even wilder than the Kozaks, yet he is crafty as a mountain lion.
It is more through wild animal instinct than through intelligence," answered Ghaznavi. "The other Kozaks are at least descendants of civilized men. He is a barbarian. But to dispose of him would be to deal them a crippling blow."
"But how?" demanded Jehungir. "He has repeatedly cut his way out of spots that seemed certain death for him. And, instinct or cunning, he has avoided or escaped every trap set for him."
"For every beast and for every man there is a trap he will not escape," quoth Ghaznavi. When we have parleyed with the Kozaki for the ransom of captives, I have observed this man Conan. He has a keen relish for women and strong drink. Have your captive Octavia fetched here."
Jehungir clapped his hands, and an impassive Kushite eunuch, an image of shining ebony and silken pantaloons, bowed before him and went to do his bidding. Presently he returned, leading by the wrist a tall, handsome girl, whose yellow hair, clear eyes, and fair skin identified her as a pure-blooded member of her race. Her scanty silk tunic, girded at the waist, displayed the marvelous contours of her magnificent figure. Her fine eyes flashed with resentment, and her red lips were sulky, but submission had been taught her during her captivity. She stood with hanging head before her master until he motioned her to a seat on the divan beside him. Then he looked inquiringly at Ghaznavi.
"We must lure Conan away from the Cossacks," said the counselor abruptly. "Their war camp is at present pitched somewhere on the lower reaches of the Zaporozhka River, which, as you well know, is a wilderness of reeds, a swampy jungle in which our last expedition was cut to pieces by those masterless devils."
"I am not likely to forget that," said Jehungir wryly.
"There is an uninhabited island near the mainland," said Ghaznavi, "known as Shapur, the Fortified, because of some ancient ruins upon it. There is a peculiarity about it which makes it perfect for our purpose. It has no shoreline, but rises sheer out of the sea in cliffs 150 feet tall. Not even an ape could negotiate them. The only place where a man can go up or down is a narrow path on the western side that has the appearance of a worn stair, carved into the solid rock of the cliffs. If we could trap Conan on that island, alone, we could hunt him down at our leisure, with bows, as men hunt a lion."
"As well wish for the moon," said Jehungir impatiently. "Shall we send him a messenger, bidding him climb the cliffs and await our coming?"
"In effect, yes."
Seeing Jehungir's look of amazement, Ghaznavi continued,
"We will ask for a parley with the Cossacks in regard to prisoners at the edge of the steps by Fort Gori. As usual, we will go with a force and encamp outside the castle. They will come with an equal force, and the parley will go forward with the usual distrust and suspicion. But this time we will take with us, as if by casual chance, your beautiful captive."
Octavia changed color and listened with intensified interest as the counselor nodded toward her.
"She will use all her wiles to attract Conan's attention. That should not be difficult. To that wild reaver she should appear a dazzling vision of loveliness. Her vitality and substantial figure should appeal to him more vividly than would one of the doll-like beauties of your Seraglio."
Octavia sprang up, her white fists clenched, her eyes blazing and her figure quivering with outraged anger.
"You would force me to play the trollop with this barbarian?" she exclaimed. "I will not! I am no market-block slut to smirk and ogle at a steps-rubber. I am the daughter of a Numidian lord."
"You were of the Numidian nobility before my riders carried you off," returned Jehungir cynically. "Now you are merely a slave who will do as she is bid."
"I will not," she raged.
"On the contrary," rejoined Jehungir with studied cruelty, "you will. I like Ghaznavi's plan. Continue, prince among counselors."
"Conan will probably wish to buy her. You will refuse to sell her, of course, or to exchange her for Hyrcanian prisoners. He may then try to steal her, or take her by force, though I do not think even he would break the parley truce. Anyway, we must be prepared for whatever he might attempt. Then, shortly after the parley, before he has time to forget all about her, we will send a messenger to him under a flag of truce, accusing him of stealing the girl and demanding her return. He may kill the messenger, but at least he will think that she has escaped. Then we will send a spy. A Yuetshi fisherman will do, to the Kozak camp, who will tell Conan that Octavia is hiding on Shapur. If I know my man, he will go straight to that place.
But we do not know that he will go alone, Jehungir argued.
Does a man take a band of warriors with him when going to a rendezvous with a woman he desires? Retorted Ghaznavi. The chances are all that he will go alone. But he will take care of the other alternative. We will not await him on the island, where we might be trapped ourselves, but among the reeds of a marshy point which juts out to within 1,000 yards of Shapur. If he brings a large force, we'll beat a retreat and think up another plot. If he comes alone or with a small party, we will have him. Depend upon it, he will come, remembering your charming slave's smiles and meaning glances.
I will never descend to such shame.
Octavia was wild with fury and humiliation.
I will die first.
You will not die, my rebellious beauty, said Jehungir, but you will be subjected to a very painful and humiliating experience. He clapped his hands, and Octavia paled. This time it was not the Kushite who entered, but a Shemite, a heavily muscled man of medium height with a short, curled, blue-black beard. Here is work for you, Gilzan, said Jehungir. Take this fool and play with her a while. Yet be careful not to spoil her beauty. With an inarticulate grunt, the Shemite seized Octavia's wrist, and at the grasp of his iron fingers, all the defense went out of her. With a piteous cry, she tore away and threw herself on her knees before her implacable master, sobbing incoherently for mercy. Jehungir dismissed the disappointed torturer with a gesture and said to Ghaznavi, If your plan succeeds, I will fill your lap with gold.
3. In the darkness before dawn, an unaccustomed sound disturbed the solitude that slumbered over the reedy marshes and the misty waters of the coast. It was not a drowsy waterfowl nor a waking beast. It was a human who struggled through the thick reeds, which were taller than a man's head. It was a woman, had there been anyone to see, tall and yellow-haired, her splendid limbs molded by her draggled tunic. Octavia had escaped in good earnest, every outraged fiber of her still tingling from her experience in a captivity that had become unendurable. Jehungir's mastery of her had been bad enough. But with deliberate fiendishness, Jehungir had given her to a nobleman whose name was a byword for degeneracy, even in Khawazarim. Octavia's resilient flesh crawled and quivered at her memories. Desperation had nerved her climb from Jalal Khan's castle on a rope made of strips from torn tapestries, and chance had led her to a picketed horse. She had ridden all night, and dawn found her with a foundered steed on the swampy shores of the sea. Quivering with the abhorrence of being dragged back to the revolting destiny planned for her by Jalal Khan, she plunged into the morass, seeking a hiding place from the pursuit she expected. When the reeds grew thinner around her and the water rose about her thighs, she saw the dim loom of an island ahead of her. A broad span of water lay between, but she did not hesitate. She waded out until the low waves were lapping about her waist. Then she struck out strongly, swimming with a vigor that promised unusual endurance. As she neared the island, she saw that it rose sheer from the water in castle-like cliffs. She reached them at last, but found neither ledge to stand on below the water, nor to cling to above. She swam on, following the curve of the cliffs, the strain of her long flight beginning to weight her limbs. Her hands fluttered along the sheer stone, and suddenly they found a depression. With a sobbing gasp of relief, she pulled herself out of the water and clung there, a dripping white goddess in the dim starlight. She had come upon what seemed to be steps carved in the cliff. Up them she went, flattening herself against the stone as she caught the faint clack of muffled oars. She strained her eyes and thought she made out a vague bulk moving toward the reedy point she had just quitted. But it was too far away for her to be sure, in the darkness, and presently the faint sound ceased and she continued her climb. If it were her pursuers, she knew of no better course than to hide on the island. She knew that most of the islands off that marshy coast were uninhabited. This might be a pirate's lair, but even pirates would be preferable to the beast she had escaped. A vagrant thought crossed her mind as she climbed, in which she mentally compared her former master with the Cossack chief with whom, by compulsion, she had shamelessly flirted in the pavilions of the camp by Fort Gory, where the Hyrcanian lords had parleyed with the warriors of the steppes. His burning gaze had frightened and humiliated her, but his cleanly elemental fierceness set him above Jalal Khan, a monster such as only an overly opulent civilization can produce. She scrambled up over the cliff edge and looked timidly at the dense shadows which confronted her. The trees grew close to the cliffs, presenting a solid mass of blackness. Something whirred above her head and she cowered, even though realizing it was only a bat. She did not like the looks of those ebony shadows, but she set her teeth and went toward them, trying not to think of snakes. Her bare feet made no sound in the spongy loam under the trees. Once among them, the darkness closed frighteningly about her. She had not taken a dozen steps when she was no longer able to look back and see the cliffs and the sea beyond. A few steps more and she became hopelessly confused and lost her sense of direction. Through the tangled branches not even a star peered. She groped and floundered on, blindly, and then came to a sudden halt. Somewhere ahead there began the rhythmical booming of a drum. It was not such a sound as she would have expected to hear in the time and place. Then she forgot it as she was aware of a presence near her. She could not see, but she knew that something was standing beside her in the darkness. With a stifled cry, she shrank back, and as she did so, something that even in her panic she recognized as a human arm curved about her waist. She screamed and threw all her supple young strength into a wild lunge for freedom, but her captor caught her up like a child, crushing her frantic resistance with ease. The silence with which her frenzied pleas and protests were received added to her terror as she felt herself being carried through the darkness toward the distant drum, which still pulsed and muttered. 4. As the first tinge of dawn reddened the sea, a small boat with a solitary occupant approached the cliffs. The man in the boat was a picturesque figure. A crimson scarf was knotted about his head. His wide silk breeches, of flaming hue, were upheld by a broad sash, which likewise supported a scimitar and a shagreen scabbard. His gilt-worked leather boots suggested the horseman rather than the seaman, but he handled his boat with skill. Through his widely open white silk shirt showed his broad, muscular breast, burned brown by the sun. The muscles of his heavy, bronzed arms rippled as he pulled the oars with an almost feline ease of motion. A fierce vitality that was evident in each feature and motion set him apart from common men, yet his expression was neither savage nor somber, though the smoldering blue eyes hinted at ferocity easily wakened. This was Conan, who had wandered into the armed camps of the Cossacks with no other possessions than his wits and his sword, and who had carved his way to leadership among them. He paddled to the carven stair as one familiar with his environs, and moored the boat to a projection of the rock. Then he went up the worn steps without hesitation. He was keenly alert, not because he consciously suspected hidden danger, but because alertness was a part of him, wedded by the wild existence he followed. What Ghaznavi had considered animal intuition or some sixth sense was merely the razor-edged faculties and savage wit of the barbarian. Conan had no instinct to tell him that men were watching him from a covert among the reeds of the mainland. As he climbed the cliff, one of these men breathed deeply and stealthily lifted a bow. Jehungir caught his wrist and hissed an oath into his ear.
"Fool! Will you betray us? Don't you realize he is out of range? Let him get upon the island. He will go looking for the girl. We will stay here a while. He may have sensed our presence or guessed our plot. He may have warriors hidden somewhere. We will wait. In an hour, if nothing suspicious occurs, we'll row up to the foot of the stair and await him there. If he does not return in a reasonable time, some of us will go upon the island and hunt him down. But I do not wish to do that if it can be helped. Some of us are sure to die if we have to go into the bush after him. I had rather catch him descending the stair, where we can feather him with arrows from a safe distance."
Meanwhile, the unsuspecting Kozak had plunged into the forest. He went silently in his soft leather boots, his gaze sifting every shadow in eagerness to catch sight of the splendid, tawny-haired beauty of whom he had dreamed ever since he had seen her in the pavilion of Jehungir Agha by Fort Gori. He would have desired her even if she had displayed repugnance toward him. But her cryptic smiles and glances had fired his blood, and with all the lawless violence which was his heritage, he desired that white-skinned, golden-haired woman of civilization. He had been on Shapur before. Less than a month ago, he had held a secret conclave here with a pirate crew. He knew that he was approaching a point where he could see the mysterious ruins which gave the island its name, and he wondered if he would find the girl hiding among them. Even with the thought, he stopped as though struck dead. Ahead of him, among the trees, rose something that his reason told him was not possible. It was a great dark green wall, with towers rearing beyond the battlements. Conan stood paralyzed in the disruption of the faculties which demoralizes anyone who is confronted by an impossible negation of sanity. He doubted neither his sight nor his reason, but something was monstrously out of joint. Less than a month ago, only broken ruins had showed among the trees. What human hands could rear such a mammoth pile as now met his eyes in the few weeks which had elapsed? Besides, the buccaneers who roamed Vilayet ceaselessly would have learned of any work going on such stupendous scale and would have informed the Kozaks. There was no explaining this thing. But it was so. He was on Shapur, and that fantastic teep of towering masonry was on Shapur. And all was madness and paradox. Yet it was all true. He wheeled to race back through the jungle, down the carven stair, and across the blue waters to the distant camp at the mouth of the Zaporozhka. In that moment of unreasoning panic, even the thought of halting so near the inland sea was repugnant. He would leave it behind him, would quit the armed camps and the steppes, and put 1,000 miles between him and the blue, mysterious east, where the most basic laws of nature could be set at naught, by what diabolism he could not guess. For an instant, the future fate of kingdoms that hinged on this gay-clad barbarian hung in the balance. It was a small thing that tipped the scales, merely a shred of silk hanging on a bush that caught his uneasy glance. He leaned to it, his nostrils expanding, his nerves quivering to a subtle stimulant. On that bit of torn cloth, so faint that it was less with his physical faculties than by some obscure instinctive sense that he recognized it, lingered the tantalizing perfume that he connected with the sweet, firm flesh of the woman he had seen in Jehungir's pavilion. The fisherman had not lied then. She was here. Then, in the soil, he saw a single track in the loam, the track of a bare foot, long and slender. But a man's, not a woman's, and sunk deeper than was natural. The conclusion was obvious. The man who made the track was carrying a burden. And what should it be but the girl the Kozak was seeking? he stood silently facing the dark towers that loomed through the trees, his eyes slits of blue balefire. Desire for the yellow-haired woman vied with a sullen primordial rage at whoever had taken her. His human passion fought down his ultra-human fears, and dropping into the stalking crouch of a hunting panther, he glided toward the walls, taking advantage of the dense foliage to escape detection from the battlements. As he approached, he saw that the walls were composed of the same green stone that had formed the ruins, and he was haunted by a vague sense of familiarity. It was as if he looked upon something he had never before seen, but had dreamed of or pictured mentally. At last, he recognized the sensation. The walls and towers followed the plan of the ruins. It was as if the crumbling lines had grown back into the structures they originally were.
No sound disturbed the morning quiet as Conan stole to the foot of the wall which rose sheer from the luxuriant growth. On the southern reaches of the inland sea, the vegetation was almost tropical. He saw no one on the battlements, heard no sounds within. He saw a massive gate a short distance to his left, and had no reason to suppose that it was not locked and guarded. But he believed that the woman he sought was somewhere beyond that wall, and the course he took was characteristically reckless.
Above him, vine-festooned branches reached out toward the battlements. He went up a great tree like a cat, and reaching a point above the parapet, he gripped a thick limb with both hands, swung back and forth at arm's length until he had gained momentum, and then let go and catapulted through the air, landing cat-like on the battlements. Crouching there, he stared down into the streets of a city. The circumference of the wall was not great, but the number of green stone buildings it contained was surprising. They were 3 or 4 stories in height, mainly flat-roofed, reflecting a fine architectural style. The streets converged like the spokes of a wheel into an octagon-shaped court in the center of the town, which gave upon a lofty edifice which, with its domes and towers, dominated the whole city. He saw no one moving in the streets or looking out of the windows, though the sun was already coming up. The silence that reigned there might have been that of a dead and deserted city. A narrow stone stair ascended the wall near him. Down this he went. Houses shouldered so closely to the wall that halfway down the stair he found himself within arm's length of a window and halted to peer in. There were no bars, and the silk curtains were caught back with satin cords. He looked into a chamber whose walls were hidden by dark velvet tapestries. The floor was covered with thick rugs, and there were benches of polished ebony and an ivory dais heaped with furs. He was about to continue his descent when he heard the sound of someone approaching in the street below. Before the unknown person could round a corner and see him on the stair, he stepped quickly across the intervening space and dropped lightly into the room, drawing his scimitar. He stood for an instant, statue-like. Then, as nothing happened, he was moving across the rugs toward an arched doorway, when a hanging was drawn aside.